Welcome to Pemba On Demand. I'm Norm Chapin, your host. I am very excited to welcome you to our podcast. Pemba On Demand is produced for physicians interested in professional development. We will be discussing a wide range of topics on the podcast. I will be interviewing physician leaders from the U.S. and from other countries who have graduated from the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee. These physicians will be sharing stories of professional and personal growth, overcoming challenges in their organizations, and discussing key leadership skills they have learned from the MBA program and ongoing professional development. In this episode of Pemba On Demand, Navigating a Crisis, the Pandemic's Influence on Medical Education, with a veteran physician executive, we have as our guest Dr. James Calvin, Pemba 2012. Dr. Calvin received his medical degree, his Doctor of Medicine degree from Dalhousie University, and completed a residency in internal medicine and a fellowship in cardiology. He also completed a postdoctoral fellowship in cardiovascular research in 1983. He completed his MBA at the University of Tennessee Haslam College of Business in 2012. More recently, Dr. Calvin obtained a certificate in artificial intelligence and data science for leaders and strategic storytelling at the University of Chicago. Employed by Western University in London, Ontario, as chair and chief of the Department of Medicine, he served in many leadership roles during his over 10-year tenure at Western University. Stints at Rush University Medical Center and Cook County during the late 1990s and early 2000s are also significant achievements in his resume. It is a great pleasure to welcome Dr. Calvin to Pemba On Demand. Welcome to Pemba On Demand. We're happy to have you here for another episode of our show. Today's show, we're going to be talking about navigating a crisis, the pandemic's influence on medical education, with a veteran physician executive, Dr. Jim Calvin. Jim is the professor of medicine at Western University in London, Ontario, and I'm really excited to have him on the show today. So, Jim, welcome to Pemba On Demand.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
It's exciting to have you here today. I appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule and giving us some of your insights. I know you and I have been talking about and planning this for some time now, but it's exciting to finally see that it's happening. So, thank you very much for coming on.
Great.
So I thought maybe we'd start a little bit and talking a little bit about your many experiences. And today I really do want to focus on the experience that you had when you were at Western University in London, Ontario. You've had experience both in American and Canadian health systems, but I wonder if you could share with the audience a little bit about specifically how COVID-19 affected medical schools and residencies, different types of training programs that you were responsible for in London, Ontario.
Sure. Quite happy to do that. Western University is actually a fairly large university in London, Ontario, which is it's situated really halfway between Detroit and Toronto. There are probably about 38,000 to 40,000 students in the university. In our program, in internal medicine, just the general internal medicine program, it had approximately 35 to 40 residents per year for a three-year program, on top of which we had subspecialty programs which were certified by the Royal College. The Royal College is kind of a player in all of this. It's really the credentialing body for specialties, including internal medicine, but also the subspecialties of internal medicine. And its governance actually did play a role in COVID. So my experience really is with COVID has been limited to what we saw in Canada, but we did see an awful lot of COVID. And we had various phases that we lived through. Over the course of 3 years, we had one residency class that actually did pretty much their entire training under COVID. They were not happy campers by the time that was all done. Others had bits and pieces of it. And out of it came a lot of discussion at a national level in terms of medical education itself, especially in internal medicine, and how we should go forward. Residents were not happy with the experience. So what was their experience like, I guess, to start off? Obviously, when COVID hit, it was a great unknown. At the very first phase, we really suffered by not having an awful lot of PPE. So the supply chains were really not there in place. We didn't have testing in the early phase. Testing actually complicated matters because people would be testing positive who weren't really sick, but then they'd end up having to be quarantined for up to 10 days, which meant that the supply chain on both attendings and the residents was actually being affected. And the program director was beside himself actually trying to cover things. So that was kind of an ongoing concern throughout the 3 years. Interestingly, there were aspects of hospital management which were really taken over by public health in the province. So they would be, we would have outbreaks where we'd have to close wards. And then we'd have to quarantine patients or cohort patients, which causes a great deal of disruption. And out of that, the distancing rules had some impact with things such as rounding, such as having classroom lectures. Having lectures where you used to serve a lunch, but you couldn't really do that anymore, or it was kind of a wrapped sandwich, if you will. So there were all of these things that were going on, and everybody was trying to cope with it. And you know, in the early days, we really didn't have a sense of where things were going to be heading. So there was a lot of anxiety. And there was a lot written about anxiety. There was anxiety about the unexpected. Being able to finish the program, people were worried about whether they were getting an adequate teaching experience because of the interruptions. Medicine still managed to have a pretty full inpatient schedule, whereas procedural specialties did not. Surgery was cut back a great deal. Mm-hmm. Even things cardiac surgery and cardiac procedures are influenced by all this, which created a lot of imbalances, I guess, in terms of getting things done. So there were backlogs of patients, and there were times when you're very busy. People were worried about their families, and because there was separation, they were also kind of concerned about themselves in terms of whether they would get sick, what would it mean? And so this anxiety played into a lot of stress. And contributed, I think, a lot to the overall wellness of both residents and attendings.
Did you have any residents who dropped out of the residency during the COVID pandemic because that anxiety or fear became insurmountable for them?
We did not. I think that one of the reasons we did not was that early on the faculty of medicine, through its deanery, if you will, actually created a wellness program whereby every department and every division of a department had a wellness lead appointed. And so they actually created a coordinated effort to counsel people and to be able to intervene. Our Department of Psychiatry also became involved in that as well in terms of managing people who are feeling a great deal of mental stress. In our particular program, even we presented what we were doing to all the other chairs of medicine across the country. So I think that we probably shut down a lot of anxiety and stress by some of those measures. If we hadn't done it, God knows what would happen. We do know that despite all of that, the class that went through 3 years of COVID was not really a very happy class by the end of it because it was just sustained, right? Sustained stress. Their concern about whether they would be able to pass their exams or they were going to be capable of being a good practitioner, those sorts of things. So those things kind of led That was not isolated to our institution. That was something that was felt in all training programs across the country.
Did you get any follow-up from that class after they graduated? Do you have any outcome data in terms of whether their concerns in terms of how well they performed as attendings was different than prior residency groups that had graduated from Western?
Yes. Interestingly, approximately 4 or 5 years before, we had actually had an accreditation survey by the Royal College, which we passed with flying colors and were given an 8-year cycle for review. We thought at the start of things, we were doing okay because we had just gone through. By the end of it, the residents were actually voicing their complaints, and it was going all the way to the associate dean for residency training programs. And they started to conduct surveys of residents. And that's where we started to get some important feedback about what was going on between residents and attendees. And I think that what was happening was there was a separation, if you will. The residents found themselves more on their own. They felt that the one-on-one teaching was less than it had been, and so they thought that the experience wasn't as good as it should be. And there were a number of attendings who were actually cited, and we had to sit down and review with them what the expectations were going forward. They were going to continue with teaching. So that was something that we had never had to do before, but I think that certainly was, in terms of our program, that was one of the feedbacks that I really had to deal with. Now, as I have a residency training director who normally handles most of this stuff, but this stuff was getting to my attention because some of these complaints are pretty serious and it really required the authority of the chair of the department to deal with them. So we did. And, you know, I think there were 3 or 4 out of about, you know, I think I have something somewhere in the vicinity of 150 teachers in the department. So It was something new, but it was something that was serious enough that it required attention. Now, interestingly, within the country, the Royal College had scheduled 3 surveys or accreditation reviews. Programs across the country, and they were large programs. And in each case, they cited the internal medicine department training program, and it was largely because residents were complaining about it and complaining about the experience. And so, without naming the programs, they were well-known programs, large programs, who basically were just trying to emerge from COVID and surviving COVID. And now the Royal College was telling them that they were kind of failing the standard. And in Canada, you know, there are about 17 training programs across the country. So the chairs of medicine actually get together twice a year. And we sat down with the Royal College to go over these results and let them know that we were not pleased with what their approach had been. And ultimately that led to the Royal College setting up kind of a 3-day workshop on the future of medical education in Canada in internal medicine. I think that was important that they did that because the solutions were not going to be found just within the programs themselves. This required funding from provincial governments who fund the residency programs. It required hospital operations to actually be more involved in the training and the educational programming that's performed under their roof. It has impact on what was expected from attendings, which I told you that we had to deal with some of that directly. And the program governance within an internal medicine program, an individual program, had to be reviewed and made clear what was going to be expected.
So were these issues that had existed prior to the pandemic, but because of the overall dissatisfaction with the residents about the learning environment or because of the stress they were under from COVID, they came up during the COVID pandemic, or were these situations that existed because of and related to the COVID pandemic? So then the Royal College came in and decided to do a major overhaul of the way that internal medicine residency training and education was done in the country.
Well, I think it's a combination of factors. My suspicion is that little problems that were perhaps not getting dealt with suddenly became major problems under the threat of COVID and the stress of COVID. And people were speaking out. And with the Royal College, you see, the Royal College didn't anticipate this. So they went on their merry way going in and surveying programs and then giving people notice that they were going to shut them down without really informing the program of what it had to do to improve or actually engaging with other stakeholders about what roles they should be having in all of this. So, and indeed, a lot of this we had to deal with within the program itself. I would say that within internal medicine across the country, in our program also, we started to realize we had to create kind of what we call a non-teacher, non-resident service, whereby we could decant, if you will, the high patient loads that they were seeing on the internal medicine services. Well, how do you pay for these people? So indeed, we worked out deals with the hospital to create more hospitalists than what we normally had, for instance. But that was one way to actually reduce some of the workload so that it was much more manageable. The government didn't come in and fund it. The Royal College didn't fund it. Somewhere the hospitals and the departments had to figure out how to do this. That was an important effort on our... I think the teaching programs themselves were affected by more limitation on one-to-one teaching or in-person teaching, which I think created more distance between attendings and the residents than one would want to see happen. And so the connection between learner and teacher was being lost. And I think that also played a role. So there are probably physicians' performance that probably wasn't as good as we might have liked in general. But once you threw on such things as the distancing, separation, and the heavy workload that would... And internal medicine had at times a very high workload because it was the only place where patients were coming. The family doctors weren't seeing them, so they'd end up in the emergency room and we'd end up admitting them. And that was another adaptation that we did, was we created an ambulatory clinic for COVID patients that was a virtual clinic that we had never had before. Mm-hmm. So give patients, pulse oximetry to take home and an algorithm of when they should call for help. But that kept people out of hospital. And ultimately, later on, as we got used to it, it allowed us to discharge more people, or at least discharge them faster.
Do you think that a lot of these changes that the Royal College implemented with the academic institutions do you anticipate that they'll remain in place?
Well, I think some things are. I think that the, virtual education, I think, is here to stay. In a city hospitals that our residents go to, and driving around the city to do a lecture here and then go back to do a service or a clinic over there was kind of crazy and a waste of time. And being able to do it virtually, it was something that people got good at and liked it. And so I think that's to stay. I think that the non-teaching services are likely to stay as well, just because there's so many patients. We run census even now after the pandemic is over. We still run a census from, 100 to 105%. We're always trying to find beds in the morning. And being able to have a non-teaching service gives us a way to manage those patients without necessarily having to completely shut down the normal teaching and rounding that goes on a teaching service or teaching unit. So I think that's likely to stay. Do I think the hospitals are going to come up with more money? The hospital that I have been working at got millions of dollars of deficit and debt. So I don't see them. What I do think is that the Department of Medicine has done well and is able to do some things financially to kind of relieve some pressure. What will happen with government? Hard to say. I think the rural college, found this a learning experience for them as to how they conduct surveys. I think they'll revise those surveys and realize their methodology is got to be more informative and helpful as opposed to punitive. So I think, and the fact is that everybody was in on the conversation, it's out there.
Yeah.
Everybody knows about it and people are talking across the country. So I think in the Rural College found out that the chiefs of medicine can get really pissed off at them. Can you imagine them taking us out to dinner? I can remember this one dinner where one of the chairs came into the dinner late because their plane had arrived late. And we were just through like appetizers, and they came in and they just unloaded on the college because they were given notice of intent to withdraw. And so that just unleashed really a lot of comments from chairs about what they didn't like about how they were going about doing it and how unhelpful was that approach during it.
So did they actually close down any programs like they had threatened or not?
No, actually, the last time that I had a conversation about this, which was a few months ago, two of the programs had actually basically gotten a waiver. So they weren't under that threat. And another one had applied for it. And I didn't hear whether they had gotten it or not. But I think that first of all, if you shut down one or two programs, you're paralyzing the entire pipeline.
Yeah.
The country can't afford that. It's a stupid thing to try to do. What you really have to do is kind of reach out and say, okay, what's going on here? What can we do to help? And I think they got that message. All I know is that the president of the Rural College kind of left the position not long after that. Maybe the kitchen got a little hot.
This podcast is sponsored by the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville's Haslam College of Business. In less than one calendar year, this program will equip you with valuable business acumen and leadership development not found in traditional medical school curriculum. Are you ready to join the longest-running physician-only MBA program in the country and a network of nearly 1,000 PEMBA graduates? Visit tiny.utk.edu/POD podcast for information about this exciting opportunity. And now we'll return to the episode. So I guess from the standpoint of impact on resident education, did you see any change in the percentage of residents who went into fellowships during this time versus those that decided to leave training and go into primary care internal medicine?
No, I think that didn't change.
That did not change?
No.
Okay. And you mentioned the impact on some of them.
Get out of the internal medicine program. But the internal medicine does have a fellowship training program as part of that. And they have lots of applicants. And people who went into family medicine, generally speaking, they've made those decisions in their fourth year of medicine. So there wasn't that kind of change. So people were always trying to figure out what specialty that they wanted to go into. And every year we have our graduation party. We review all the third years as to where it is they're all going, and they all seem to find a home.
Yeah. Do you have any sense from your conversations with the chairs of other departments like surgery, family medicine, OBGYN, orthopedics, did they have similar experiences to the medicine residencies? Or I know you mentioned earlier with obviously surgeries and procedures were really curtailed pretty significantly for the majority of the pandemic, or at least for the first year and a half.
Yeah, one wonders whether that chicken is coming to home to roost right now, because they're trying to, we did some analyses. We did a lot of analyses with COVID. We were meeting almost every day during some periods of this, and we would have people would actually prepare the impact of COVID on procedures and surgeries in particular. And I think that, you know, some of the estimates were just mind-boggling as to the sufficient delays or waiting lists that would take years to make up. And so that's got to play itself out. And that will create kind of workload issues, I'm sure, as well as patient dissatisfaction, I suspect. So it was a pretty sizable impact in Canada. I would say that one of the things that we did a reasonably good job with this, and there were a lot of, I thought it was one of the times in my 10 years there that the hospital actually adapted well and found better ways of doing things. And we were able to manage beds well enough that we were taking patients from out of province and from other cities in Ontario because we had beds and they didn't. So that was told me that our approach was as reasonable as what anybody else was doing if we could do that.
I'd like to go back to kind of you mentioned the wellness program that you initiated. How early in the COVID pandemic did you find it necessary to implement that program?
That came forward probably within the first 6 months. It got launched, got refined, and actually it was presented in a number of places because people wanted to hear about what we were doing.
Was there a mandatory component to participating in that, or was it left up to the individual resident or medical student or even faculty member?
I think that the leads met to discuss common issues, but I would say operationally it was often one-on-one with the lead and an individual that would approach the lead if, in fact, they were feeling that they had an issue that they needed to discuss. And while it operated then in kind of maybe not as rigid, the fact of the matter is everybody knew it was there if they needed it.
So what's your sense of what percentage of your residents during this period of time took advantage of it? Did you get any sense of utilization of the program?
I would say there are probably a couple per division. So let's just say offhand, that's 28 people out of a total residency of about 120. Okay. So you're probably looking a little bit more than 20%. So it's not that everybody needed it or had to use it. Some people just grumble, you know. Some people really were stressed.
Yes. And I know I asked you this question about your own programs, but in the United States, we did hear about some pretty significant mental health impacts from COVID. We had, you know, we had several physicians across the country, and there was already sort of a concern about burnout and physician suicide, those types of things. As you met with the other chairs of medicine, did any of those other programs experience any significant injuries like that to physicians where they committed suicide or just could no longer practice medicine?
Well, I think people manage quite well now. I haven't seen any statistics on this, but I haven't really heard of any serious cases. Could there be somebody who dropped out here or there that I wouldn't know about? Yeah, that's probably possible. But the burnout issue was already in play before COVID.
Yes.
And so I think that was one of the reasons why we were able to react as quickly as we did during COVID is because we were already thinking about wellness and we had an associate dean who was going to take it on. And so the ideas were already formulated. It just that it expanded and scaled up.
Okay. So your organization was focusing on it to deal with the sort of the burnout crisis prior to that and just led to a higher level of interest or focus on it. Did they create a specific position? Some people, I don't think anybody calls them chief burnout officers, but they're a chief wellness officer or something like that. Did your organization deal with this from within the existing structure or did they create a specific person who was responsible for the well-being initiatives?
This, to answer the question, I just give you a very quick background. The university and the hospitals are different corporations. That's why I was a chair and a chief. I was a chair of the university department. I was chief of affiliated hospital departments, medicine. And so what we found was the university was much more proactive. They created a leadership position within the dean's office. And then they asked the chairs of the departments acting under the university rubric to appoint leads for the department and as well as leads within each division. And so that's kind of how we operated. And so the hospital, I think, has 15,000 employees. I think they were probably busy enough dealing with their own stuff and were quite happy for us to try to figure out what to do with learners.
Right. So I guess, and you mentioned this earlier too, that how public health became so much more ingrained in the operations of healthcare organizations. And I think we saw the same thing here in the United States. I had been working in inpatient settings for many, many years. And up until the COVID pandemic, I could count on one hand the number of times I had met with our county health department and officers. Do you think that that's a relationship and a relationship and a operationally that is going to continue now that we're seeing a decline in the COVID pandemic? Or do you think that that will continue to be something that the health departments and public health officials and hospitals tend to maintain a higher level of collaboration around potential pandemics in the future?
Well, I'm not sure about that. First of all, it's difficult enough if you are a clinical lead in a department, in a hospital, and you have also responsibilities to another corporation, i.e. the university, and then you throw in public health on top of that, and you sort of say, well what gives here? How do I run my department if I'm being told what to do? Being told what to do, not necessarily by the person who signed my contract. Mm-hmm. To be honest. So I think, on the other hand, they had better information. One of the things that I did in my department, I have a division of infectious disease. So I actually had physicians within the department who were actually engaging with public health to kind of negotiate some of the decisions that needed to be made. And we used those ID doctors to be spokesmen both ways, to talk to public health, but at the same time to also inform all the other division heads. And in fact, would have regular meetings with our division heads to kind of just to keep them up to date on what was going on with the pandemic. And so that kind of got around a lot of potential friction. I didn't feel any real friction from, except that it's not like they were coming to me and sort of saying, you got to do this, you got to do that. They would go to the hospital and then the hospital would start to make decisions and I would have to react to those decisions because how am I going to cover this? How am I going to cover that?
What are your thoughts as you look back on the pandemic? There was so much that we didn't know, as you said, at the beginning of the pandemic compared to at the end of the pandemic. In your opinion, do you think that in spite of the fact that we had very limited knowledge at the beginning, are there things that you think now that we could have done differently in our response, either the public health response or the governmental response in Canada, or even the academic institution's response?
Well, if a new virus came into our environment, how we go about doing it? Well, the fact of the matter is, I think people looking back, you know, in hindsight, the lockdowns were probably overdone. The impact on the educational system, I think, was significant. We weren't ready for it when it started. So all the supply chains, really, we were really adrift on that. We'd have to be ready the next time. I think my own personal opinion about vaccines is it did have a positive impact, although, you know, if you do a clinical trial, a lot of these clinical trials, non-vaccine clinical trials, let's say just a cardiology trial, we might be looking at a 2-year or 3-year outcome event. We mm-hmm. like to know that it's safe, not in the short term or long term. But the vaccines were just rapidly rolled out. It was quite amazing how fast it came out. But what happens then is some of the black swan events actually do crop up, but they're later on down the line. And I guess the question is, can you do that safer maybe than what we did? But if you go back to the early days of the pandemic, I mean, people were falling like flies. It was scary. Mm-hmm. No doubt about it, it was scary. And people were looking for a quick fix. There's arguments about other drugs that might have been used or that were frowned on. And I'm not an expert on that. But in Canada, I would say, and it's probably true in the U.S., that when you're dealing with something where there's an unknown and it's a bit potentially dangerous outcomes, more people are going to try to stay within what the guidelines are, what the recommendations are. And so I think that that's kind of natural for us to be that way at the same time. But there's always a cost benefit to these things. So I think that I'm sure that we haven't finished writing about COVID-19, how it was handled.
I've had several colleagues who've, I would say, maybe to put it most appropriately, I've had several colleagues who were concerned about how the potential risks were minimized in spite of the face of long-term data, the lack of long-term data. And I think their concern was that we were so focused on the safety in the short term that maybe there wasn't enough of a disclaimer stating that we just really didn't have any evidence around what the long-term impact would be. But again, when you put ourselves in the situation that we were faced with, I don't know that there's any way that we could have handled that a little bit differently without having an impact on the number of people who were willing to get vaccinated. But I think you're right. I think it's going to be years before we know what the impact of that approach was in terms of long-term health risks for patients.
The one thing I thought about is if you're really taking a drug, or you're taking a vaccine in this particular case that has not had long-term studies, shouldn't you actually be honest with the patient that there's an unknown and allow them to consent? I mean, that's how we would handle it otherwise. And that wasn't done. It was being mandated. And I think that was a leap of faith. It's just a little bit too far.
Yeah, I certainly share your concern on that. And I kind of agree with you. I think we didn't do a good enough job of making sure we were really fully informing people that there was this unknown aspect to our knowledge at that point. So, well, maybe we could pivot a little bit at this point and kind of talk about your experience with Pemba specifically. I know you've had a very storied career. You had leadership positions in the U.S. and then went back into the Canadian system where you trained. But I'd like to specifically talk with you about where you were in your career when you decided to pursue an MBA, and why did you feel that would be beneficial to you?
Okay. So do you want the short story or the long story on this one?
I want the best story.
Somehow I actually had some attraction to leadership early on. So I worked as a cardiologist at a heart institute in Canada, University of Ottawa Heart Institute. I became CCU director as well. I became the director of technical services. So I was able to interact with the leadership of that group early on in my career, and they entrusted me so that I sort of felt confident. When I went to Rush in 1991, Rush didn't have a coronary care unit. I actually was the first director of the CCU. It was brand new CCU. And I realized that I was going to be responsible for things like quality. And so I started to think about quality and quality improvement. And especially as Medicare started to have goals on the quality side of things and paid for them, I had to learn how I was going to actually get high adherence by physicians. And I actually published a paper out of that using guideline reminders to improve performance, improved outcome. So that got me interested even more. And then a job came up at Cook County. And Cook County is like, if you can do it at Cook County, you can do it anywhere because you don't have any resources. You have to kind of figure out how to you know, get the resources to do things. But as the chair of cardiology at that hospital, I really had an enormous impact on how cardiology behaved, because I did the budgets, I arranged the clinic, arranged the schedules. And then I started to, impose some of the quality standards. That led to going back to Rush to be the director of cardiology. And what then I realized there was a big jump up, because it was bigger, more staff, and quite dependent on being able to compete in the marketplace. A lot of medical schools in Chicago, a lot of private institutions and systems that you were up against. And I became quite aware of how complicated that was. I can imagine in Cook County, the people come because it's where they know they're going to be looked after. Okay. But at Rush, people have choices, because they could go to Northwestern, they could go to Loyola, they could, go to University of Chicago. So you had to be on your toes. And at that point, I actually did an executive leadership course through Loyola. I think that helped me survive 10 years there. But towards the end of it, the demands were such that I realized I actually had to know more. I actually wanted to be able to write my own business plans without, administrators, lay administrators don't always see things the way that the physician might. And I wanted to be able to write a convincing, business plan that would be respected, accepted, and would actually be workable. So I knew I had to learn how to do that. And I had to learn more about finance. And I was under a lot of pressure at the time. I wrote a paper called Overcoming the Perfect Storm, and where I kind of gave the blueprint of what you do when you're $5 million in the hole in a division and you have to get out of it in a year. And a lot of, when you're $5 million in the hole, when you've got, your gross revenue is about $25 million, you can't fix that without affecting people and programs. And so I went through that process, but realized I wasn't happy about all that. And my confidence actually took a big hit. So the idea of going to business school was I needed to have an awakening. Was I going to cope with this? I was either going to have to quit what I was doing and think of another career, or I was going to have to get better at it. And so that's what I decided to do. It was interesting. I wanted to do it probably 7 or 8 years before that, but chair of medicine said not to bother. It wouldn't matter there. But what I found is that ultimately it mattered where I went to at Western, because I think that the knowledge that I got, Pemba had a big impact on me. And then I had a big impact on my department by virtue of being able to bring good business practices into play.
And how did you choose? I mean, Chicago has a lot of opportunities for higher education. How did you choose the University of Tennessee over a more local option?
Well, most people probably would have done the local option. I think I wanted to work. So I wanted to do something that was online. I wanted to do something that was could be done in a year or a little longer. Talked to people about the program, what it would be like, and thought, I thought that I could do that and at the same time be chair of cardiology, that okay. I could do those, they could coexist.
So you were specifically looking for business acumen, business skills, business knowledge, and it sounds like that's why you chose an MBA over some of the other advanced degrees, such as a master's in public health or a master's in health system administration. Did you look at those programs, or did you gravitate immediately to an MBA program?
I no doubt I gravitated directly to the MBA. And the reason was that I had business shoved down my throat every day. Mm-hmm. I had something every month. The hospital would publish a run rate for all departments and divisions. Okay. And it was basically like an A3 form. So it was kind of long. I had every revenue center, every cost center. And of course, the lower right cell was the one that told you whether you were going to have a lot of meetings in the next month. And so you'd have to actually go in and try to figure out why you were losing. But if you're doing that, if you're going in and reporting to the dean every week, as I was, about this stuff, you realize, well, if they're interested only in the money, okay, I have to be interested in the money. Because if I don't have the money, everything else falls apart. That's probably one of the big lessons I got out of this is you've got to figure a way to be able to make sufficient funds to actually pay for your program. And if Rush made me very aware of that reality, Pemba helped with me being able to figure out what tools I needed to be accomplished at it.
And how did you balance with, in my experience, when I talk to physicians, of course, there's a lot of focus on quality outcomes, quality improvement. There's also, depending on the way the compensation plan is structured, a concern about productivity and the financial aspects of it. Did you learn skills at Pemba that helped you balance the approach from the financial aspect and the concerns the dean had while also maintaining a focus on the outcomes and the quality that you were producing?
I would say at Rush, I never really had a really good chance to reconcile those things, but I brought them with me to Western. So I created a balanced scorecard at Western. In part, I learned what a balanced scorecard was through Pemba, and I also learned about it when I did the course in Loyola a decade before. What I figured out how to do at Western was how to get the information electronically. Since we had to keep track of teaching hours and teaching evaluations, and the hospital had care data like, you know, mortality and readmission rates and such as that. And of course, we kept track of grants and papers, did that all regularly. You actually had a system whereby you could bring in elements of the tripartite mission. And so once we figured out how we were going to do that, and I used my business group within the department to provide that, we were able to actually create a whole different system of evaluation for not only the divisions, but the individuals within divisions. So every doctor had to sit down with his chair of division and discuss his progress in relationship to what the goals and objectives were for him, but also how he or she was doing compared to his peers. And ultimately, you might think that would be very threatening to people. And we did have to have some discussions about how it was going to be used. But what I told individuals was, I owe you feedback. How can your career develop if we're not giving you feedback on how you're performing? And they bought that. They said, yeah, that sounds reasonable. Because, you know, until I did that, a lot of the division chairs really didn't know how well people in their division were performing. But we put in a system whereby they reviewed it with the individual, and then they would have to sit down with me and we'd review everybody in their division. And I'd be asking, well, this guy, you hired this guy as a teacher. Let's look at his teaching hours and his teaching evaluations. How's he doing? Or she doing? And we would do the same thing on the research side. And then it also gave us an opportunity for people who at Western, you had to get promoted within 7 years from assistant to associate. What we found is that if people are kind of flat in their performance in the first 3 years, that is a red flag. By having a balanced scorecard, we were able to identify people who we had to do some problem solving as to how do we get you to the point where you can get promoted and turn people's careers around.
So it sounds like the knowledge that you brought from the MBA certainly was helpful and helped you deal with some of the challenges that your chair was depending on you to handle.
Yeah, I think that Pemba, we went over a lot of this. I can remember Mike Stahl, you know, talking about it. And I read a lot about it. And I went back to some of my old notes and I sort of said, you know, I think we can do this. Because, you know, you could look at it and say, oh, this is such a big thing. We'll never get this done. What I found out is if you understood, number one, the bookkeeping, but also the flow of information, and you have kind of good staff that are able to pull data out of different databases. When we first started this, we were actually doing it in Tableau. And then we ultimately created a website where we had it on one website. And so we evolved in how we did it. But nonetheless, for 8 years, we were using that system, using feedback, and we published it.
You and I have talked about this, and we're actually planning a future episode. For those of you listening on the podcast, I'm going to interview Dr. Calvin again, and we're going to talk a little bit more about how he used some of the tools, the balanced scorecard, and talk a little bit about what he implemented when he went to Western University in London. So that's going to be a live stream coming up in October, the third Tuesday in October. So if you're listening to this before October 15th of 2024, please feel free to tune in for that. And we will be publishing some information from Pemba so that you can tune into that live stream. We do those live streams at noon on the third Tuesday of each month. So I look forward to sharing that with all of you. And I'm excited that we're going to be able to take a little bit of a deeper dive into some of those innovations that you created when you went back to your roots in Canada. Well, we're pretty much at the end of our hour here. Jim, I really appreciate the time you took and the insights that you shared with us. Thank you again for agreeing to come on the podcast.
Well, thanks for having me. I hope people found it interesting, at least. And I guess if there was one message is you've got the tools after Pemba to be able to do these things. And it's an opportunity to actually have an impact that I think a regular physician would be difficult to pull off.
Great. Well, thank you again. And we'll be talking soon. And I look forward to the live stream.
Okay. I'll click off. Thank you.
Thank you. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Pemba On Demand with Dr. Calvin. I enjoyed preparing for the interview and discussing with Jim his work during COVID and his perspectives on some of the long-term impacts from the pandemic on academic institutions and physician trainees. Pemba On Demand podcasts are released bi-monthly on Thursdays. Please subscribe to Pemba On Demand in your favorite podcast player. I will have as our guest Dr. Juliana Reese. Dr. Reese is the director of Healthy Tribes Program at the CDC National Center for Chronic Disease Prevention. She is an American Indian of the Navajo tribe. She will be discussing From Heritage to Health, a Native American leader's journey to improve chronic health disparities. Our September 19th show will be titled The Dual Role of AI, Enhancing Medicine and Personal Lives with Dr. Harvey Castro. This will be a podcast that is repurposed from our live stream on August 20th, which will have Dr. Castro as our guest. The live stream on September 17th will feature Dr. Jay Greiner, The Path to Excellence, a physician executive's story of challenges and successes. Dr. Calvin, who you just heard in this podcast, will be our guest on October 15th, 2024. In a live stream entitled Development of a Center for Quality, Safety, and Innovation, drawing from his experience and leadership during his 10 years at Western University in London, Ontario. Please visit our YouTube channel at youtube.com/@PembaOn-demand for the schedule of future live streams. Please subscribe to the channel and click the notification bell to be notified of our upcoming live streams. That wraps up our show for today. Thank you very much for joining and listening to the podcast. If you have any comments or questions regarding this episode, please feel free to add them in the comment section on our website, tiny.utk.edu/podcast. We love hearing from you and are happy to answer any questions you may have. I will add a link to the website below. Please also don't forget to subscribe to the podcast by clicking the subscribe button. Add Pemba On Demand to your podcast library today. I would also appreciate it if you could leave a review of the podcast on your podcast player. Share the podcast with your friends and colleagues also. Please take good care of yourselves, and as always, good luck with your future.